Welcome to episode 24 of Messing About in Ships for May 29th, 2008. I'm Peter Mello from seafever.org, and this week we bring you a special episode. Well, actually, this week we bring you last week's episode since we had a little trouble downloading the file. I was actually in Bermuda, and we just had a few issues there. But we think it's worth the wait. It's a final installment of the ongoing story about the EPIRB on board the Sean Seymour II. And this week, John will be interviewing the captain and owner of the Sean Seymour II, Jean-Pierre Dulutz, and we think it's a great interview. And we also have our usual stuff, so hope you enjoy it. Welcome to episode 24 of Messing About in Ships. I'm Peter Mello from seafever.org, and my podcasting partner is John Conrad from gcaptain.com. Hey, John, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you doing, Peter?
I'm doing excellent, man. Happy National Maritime Day.
Yeah, exciting. Just comes around once a year. I put up the Merchant Marine flag with my son this morning. It was exciting.
Very cool. I don't have a Merchant Marine flag. I got to get me one of those, I guess. What's a Merchant Marine flag look like?
It looks like something that your neighbors might laugh at, which they did this morning, but the kids really enjoyed it.
Hey, nobody should laugh at a flag.
No, it's got the maritime symbol, and it says in peace and war. And yeah, it's a blue flag.
Cool. Cool. I don't know how much you know about National Maritime Day, but I was actually visiting the Maritime Administration's website where they got a short history on it there. So I'll just read a little bit about it from the start. It says, on May 22nd, 1819, the SS Savannah left its home port of Savannah, Georgia, on its way to Liverpool, England. The ship put to sea with steam and sails and reached Liverpool, England in 29 days and 4 hours, becoming the first steamship to cross the Atlantic. While the steam engine performed faultlessly, it was not the only means of propulsion. Historians have estimated that Savannah was under sail 80% of the time. Nonetheless, it was an impressive achievement, one that signaled the beginning of the era of steam and American technological leadership. So that's how the story started. And I guess in 1933, Congress declared May 22nd to be National Maritime Day by a joint resolution. And it says, whereas on May 22nd, 1819, the steamship the Savannah set sail from Savannah, Georgia on the first successful transoceanic voyage under steam propulsion, thus making a material contribution to the advancement of ocean transportation. Therefore, be it resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled that May 22nd of each year shall hereafter be designated and known as National Maritime Day. And the President is authorized and requested annually to issue a proclamation calling upon the people of the United States to observe such National Maritime Day by displaying the flag at their homes or other suitable places, and government officials to display the flag of all government on all government buildings on May 22nd of each year. So, John, you are definitely living the life of a proper American by flying that flag today. So, congratulations.
It's interesting. I have a little bit more history. I'm sure FDR had something to do with the first Maritime Day. He was a big proponent of the Merchant Marine and the Navy. He was also the one who secured the campus for the college I'm an alumni for, Fort Schuyler. And he gave the campus, signed it over from the federal government to the state school so they'd have a permanent home. And he was always at war with Robert Moses back when he was governor. And Mr. Moses, a couple years later, many people think to get back at FDR, put a big bridge over the campus so the beautiful views would be gone, which is still there today, the Throgs Neck Bridge. So,
wow. Huh.
But FDR was a big proponent of the Merchant Marine and Navy, so...
We'll put a link in the show notes to this webpage because they spent a lot of time on this webpage after that proclamation talking about World War II and basically the history of the day. And it goes on to say, today, National Maritime Day is observed in a variety of ways. Many U.S. seaports have open houses and special celebrations. Propeller Club chapters all over the U.S. hold special luncheons. At Merchant Marine Memorials, such as the one in New York City and the one in San Pedro, California, memorial services are held. And it goes on to say here that it is the day the nation, and particularly those in the U.S. maritime industry who are responsible for handling America's imports, exports, domestic shipments, and its millions of annual cruise passengers, honor those who currently serve and have served as merchant mariners in service to their country. So that's a bit about what we are celebrating today. But some other people celebrate Maritime Day too, don't they?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to let everyone know that maritimetv.com, we're not going to have any internet ports call today, but I just mentioned this quick. Maritimetv.com is going to live casting it today, the entire ceremony. So you'll probably miss it, but they're going to have an archive of it on that site. Also, the memorial you mentioned in San Pedro is in desperate need of donations, so we'll have a link to that in the show notes. But you were correct. The European Union observed its first ever Maritime Day 2 days ago on Tuesday, and we posted a little bit about it on GCAT, and let me read it off. The European Union has decided to celebrate the achievements and potential of Europe's ocean and seas by declaring 20 May as a dedicated European Maritime Day. The official launch ceremony will be held in Strasbourg, where Commission President and the President of the European Parliament will provide an occasion to highlight the crucial roles that sea and seas play in the everyday life, not only coastal communities, but of all European Union citizens. And we had some facts and figures about it, but I think that's an important part, that even, especially in this country where the agriculture is such a focus, you have states like Oklahoma, North and South Dakota, that don't have much going on, so the senators can really push for agriculture. The senators of maritime states, California, Florida, New York, Texas, all have bigger problems to worry about than just the maritime area. So we kind of get pushed aside. But all the supplies from overseas and all the farming equipment and things you buy at your local store, one way or another, came from the ocean. So I'm glad to see they're recognizing it.
Great. There's actually another Maritime Day too, right? The IMO has World Maritime Day, and in 2008, that's going to be celebrated on September 25th. I think the theme this year is 60 years in the service of shipping, and I think it's a celebration of IMO. So we'll have to look out for that one. That's right around Talk Like a Pirate Day too.
Yeah, sure is.
That's another national holiday, isn't it? International holiday.
For you, all those page views.
So this week we're going to do something a little different. We're going to continue our series about the Sean Seymour II rescue. But before we get there, we have Captain Kelly Sweeney with his Mariner's Perspective.
Ahoy, shipmates. This is Captain Kelly Sweeney for another Mariner's Perspective on Messing About in Ships podcast. This one's about short sea shipping. Dave, an old friend of mine, sails as a chief mate on an articulated tug and barge running in the Gulf of Mexico. Kurt, the son-in-law of a family friend, works as a deckhand on a towboat pushing barges up and down the Mississippi. Chip, the son of our local garden equipment dealer and a Maine Maritime Academy graduate, works as a first engineer on a tanker in the Gulf of Mexico. Each of these U.S. merchant mariners works on vessels plying domestic short sea shipping trade routes. Short sea shipping refers to the movement of cargo that does not cross an ocean. Typically, that means vessels plying coastal and inland routes. The primary U.S. short sea shipping routes along America's Marine Highway, a term coined by U.S. Maritime Administrator Sean Connaughton, are the Great Lakes, the inland rivers, Alaska, and Hawaii to the U.S. West Coast, and between U.S. ports along the Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf Coasts. There are many potential advantages to increasing short sea shipping along America's marine highway, since the amount of cargo that can be carried on a ship or barge is many times that which can be pulled by a truck. Increasing short sea shipping could reduce highway congestion, cut diesel exhaust, and lessen wear and tear on our bridges and highways. Total up all the companies already operating vessels on short sea shipping routes in the U.S., and you have hundreds of millions of tons of cargo moving along rivers and along coastal waterways instead of over the highways. In fact, just one company, American Commercial Line, moves around 70 million tons of cargo along short sea shipping routes each year. In 2006, I was one of the panelists and only active merchant mariner who spoke at the North American Short Sea Shipping Conference held in Vancouver, British Columbia. Speaker after speaker touted the potential benefits of short sea shipping, but until I spoke, each one ignored a major question from my perspective. How will short sea shipping affect on our domestic routes, affect the Jones Act, and U.S. merchant mariners? I will discuss further, and I'm in my next Mariner's Perspective podcast on messing about in ships next week. Until then, I wish each and one, every one of you smooth sailing.
All right. Thank you for that, Captain Kelly. Now we want to go right into our listener comments from last week. Last week we talked to Rob Stormer of Robin Storm's blog, and we talked about EPIRBs. The first comment is by Andy Warren. He said, "I really like this week's episode. I am a cadet at California Maritime Academy and recently received my GMDSS training and operator license. So all of this EPIRB talk is still fresh in my mind. I think you missed one major part of the 121.5 megahertz EPIRB. On February 1st, 2009, COPAS SARSAT satellites will no longer monitor 121.5 megahertz, and any EPIRB using that frequency will no longer work. This is to do with the problems with 121.5, most notably the lack of store and forward capability. Thanks for the podcast and keep it up. I'll miss it when I'm at sea this summer."
Well, that's great. You have any comments on Andy's comment?
Yeah, excellent comment, and he's absolutely right. 121.5 is a terrible EPIRB. Some of the older EPIRBs were just 121.5, and those will be no longer effective. They aren't discontinuing it altogether for a couple reasons. First of all, the 121.5 is the homing frequency. It's a terrestrial, like a radio signal. So when your EPIRB gives the position, or a GPIRB gives the position, the rescue helicopters are going to go to that last known position. Now, with an EPIRB, it's got to be triangulated, so it's not going to be exactly accurate. And with a GPIRB, it only gives the location every 20 minutes. So you can drift pretty far in 20 minutes. If you remember last week's C-130, the most difficult part of any rescuer's job is getting a visual on the people to be rescued. So what they do is they use that 121.5, and they have radio direction finders and home in on that signal. So it's going to be, it's still going to be important part of the EPIRB system. But Cadet Warren is absolutely right. If you have a 121.5 megahertz EPIRB, you should replace it immediately.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Andy, and for that comment. And actually, Andy's got himself charted on our listener chart, so we appreciate him plotting himself there as well. The next comment is by Jean-Pierre Delutz, and he wrote, by the way, he is also the owner and captain of the Sean Seymour 2, and we're going to hear an interview that John did with him last week. In a few minutes, but anyway, his comment is: "Your EPIRB can be the only link left with the world, and as such is a critical element of security for all mariners regardless of purpose. Ensuring their proper registration and operation is just as critical to avoid adding another entry to the long list of lost at sea statistics. Even then, do not take for granted third-party assurance that you are fully operational. Redundancy can be the best hedge against the odds. Had I not kept my old and obsolete EPIRB, I would not be here to tell the tale of two EPIRBs aboard the sailing vessel Sean Seymour II.
Yeah, redundancy is really what saved that vessel, and it's critically important. You need to have two systems. PLBs are EPIRBs. They're personal locator beacons, or EPIRBs you can clip on your belt. They sell online for $400 for a traditional EPIRB and approximately $600 for a GPIRB, GPS-enabled. And you really want two units. If you can't do that, there are other options, the Spot Personal Messenger, staying within VHF range. There are a number of options, but you want to make sure you have a backup system if you're in trouble. Very important.
Definitely.
All right, the last comment was by John Massengill. He says, I just finished listening to episode 22 with interest since I've been a Coast Guard search and rescue controller since 2000. There was a lot of misinformation about EPIRBs and how they work in the episode that I would really like to talk to you about. For example, the RCCs can get position information from both GPIRBs and EPIRBs via satellite. That is what the Homer signal on the 121.5 MHz is for. Both the 406 MHz and 121.5 MHz are detected by satellites. NOAA does not own the system. They're just a participating agency in the SARSAT partnership. They are only responsible for registering U.S. beacons, so your suggestion for people in other countries to call NOAA in Maryland will be fruitless and waste a lot of time. You also cited cell phones. Please do not rely on a cell phone to pass your position. I have only had two cases where I had enough information from a cell phone ping to close a case, and only one of them was an actual Latin long. Another time I had a ping say the guy was in North Dakota when he was actually in Virginia. So that was a little bit of a critical comment, which we absolutely welcome.
Yeah, that's what this social media stuff's all about. It's great to have made people listening and paying attention. So,
absolutely. My first comment on it is we researched all of this, and he is correct. We were absolutely wrong about the NOAA being the registration point for all the countries. It is for the U.S. only. If you buy your EPIRB, it's actually where you register your boat. So if you register your boat in another country, please don't call NOAA. You're going to have to find out locally who to call. But don't forget about it. That hex code is very, very important. You want to make sure whoever has your data has the right information. Second, he says the RCCs can get position information from both GPIRBs and EPIRBs via satellite. That is what the Homer signal on the 121.5 is for. I thought we made this pretty clear, but apparently not. EPIRBs and GPIRBs are basically the same exact thing, except the GPIRB encodes your GPS position up in the data link. Both units can home in on your location, both initially when the satellite picks it up, and later on when the Coast Guard helicopter comes. The only difference between the two is the accuracy. The traditional EPIRB has to triangulate your position using timing of the satellites, and it's not going to get it down to as close of a scale as the GPIRB. So they are going to know where you are with both units, but the GPIRB is going to be a lot more accurate. And then, like we said before, the 121.5 is the Homer signal. That's what the aircraft is going to use. They're going to put their radio direction finder equipment on you, and they're going to be able to get a line straight out to your position What the cadet was talking about previously is units that are only 121.5. They don't have the 406 satellite component. So both a GPIRB and an EPIRB are excellent units. That GPIRB is just going to give them your initial location a bit more accurately. And finally, he mentioned cell phones. And do not rely on a cell phone to pass your position. Again, this is absolutely correct. We mentioned a few other technologies like the Spot Personal Messenger, and we did give a disclaimer. EPIRB is the only unit that you should rely on in this circumstance. The absolute best thing you can have is a GPIRB on a hydrostatic release topside on your vessel. But in addition to that, you need redundancy. The best means of redundancy is a second EPIRB or a PLB personal locator beacon that you can strap to your life jacket. But barring that, these units are rather expensive, and not everyone has the money for that. Barring that, you need some form of redundancy. And all Rob was saying is that the Spot personal messenger is better than nothing. And the cell phone location is better than nothing. What Rob's comment was is if you're using a cell phone as a means of redundancy, make sure to go to the internal settings and click the enable GPS function. As Mr. Massengill said, I only had enough information from a cell phone ping. And only one of them was an actual lat and long out of the two cases. That's probably because the other person didn't have that feature enabled. So go into your cell phones, enable that feature, then forget about it, and buy two EPIRBs. I guess that's my advice.
Yeah, good advice. And we have invited Mr. Massengill to join us on the podcast, and we hope we can get him on sometime to pick his brain a little bit more with his experience. Our main story today, we're not going to do our internet ports of call. We're going to focus our C story today on the final chapter of the Sean Seymour II Rescue, the final installment, John's interview of the vessel owner, Jean-Pierre. So, John, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I'm really excited. As everyone who's been listening knows, the Sean Seymour II sunk in the North Atlantic approximately a year ago. Also that day, the sailing vessel Flying Colors was lost. It was a harrowing rescue, absolute terrible conditions. We have episode 12 was the rescue helicopter team. And then 2 weeks ago, we had the C-130 spotter plane interview. And then just prior to that, we had an EPIRB expert, Master Salver Rob Stormer, talk about these EPIRBs. Today's is the vessel captain, and he's going to talk about the actual rescue. And I'm really excited because we're getting all sides of this rescue. A few things came to note. After we did the interview, and we'll discuss that briefly when we return. But here's the captain of the Sean Seymour II. Welcome back to Messing About in Ships podcast. Today we have a special guest, Jean-Pierre of the Sean Seymour II. If you go back and look at episode 12 of Messing About in Ships podcast, we had an interview with Nevada Smith, helicopter rescue pilot, helicopter team that rescued the Sean Seymour II from the North Atlantic last year. Last week in episode 23, we had the C-130 pilot, who actually found the Sean Seymour II. And this week we have the captain of the vessel, Jean-Pierre. Good morning, John.
Good morning, John.
So that was a very interesting day. We got a good story of the rescue. Can you give us a little bit leading up to the rescue? What happened?
We were on our way to the Azores. We had left Green Cove in Florida, up on the St. John's River. We're about 5 days out, 6 days out. Weather report had announced 30 to 35 knots coming out of the north-northwest, shifting eastwards. About 6 in the morning on the 6th, we crossed an aircraft carrier that was heading back to Norfolk, and they confirmed the weather report, which was fine because I was getting ready to start reaching over and heading towards the Azores. I was about 200 miles due east of Hatteras, and so it fit my navigation plan quite well, except that by early afternoon, instead of 30 knots, we were into the 60s. And by mid-afternoon, it was just blowing harder and harder and coming out of the north-northeast. So I laid I had my heaviest rogue and battened everything down and started running with the system, which went very well from about 5 until about 2 in the morning. We recorded the maximum anemometer could record, which was 85.5 knots. It was probably stronger in the night. And then we were hit by a rogue wave, which took us broadside on the port. And just to give an idea of the power, I was at the chart table to starboard. One of my crewmates was on the settee on the port side. There was this incredible sound, and I see Ben literally flying through the air, heading straight for the starboard bulkhead. I managed to put my hands up, head and shoulders. We twisted, and he rammed his bum into the starboard and fell down on the floor. Only after that did the knockdown occur. The boat stayed steady, and it was pure kinetic energy that just projected him across. But what happened is the drogue line, and that was the real shock. The next morning when I abandoned ship, the drogue line that was through a stern cleat with chaffing tape and everything was in perfect position, except that it was snapped like a rubber band. I'd never seen nylon snap like a rubber band. It usually unravels and threads out. But after the rogue wave hit us, we lost control of the vessel for a while, and not very long after that, we did a 360 in two phases. The first phase, we went 180, and the boat stabilized there. Which worried me because I didn't suspect that she would take so long to come back. So I got out and swam and went looking for the life raft, which I couldn't find. And as I was looking for some air, I was coming up to the starboard side, port side, upside down. The boat started coming back all of a sudden and just pulled me back on board. The rig had been crushed almost longitudinal to the boat, stretching a bit off to the port side. And only then did the life raft appear. What happened, obviously, is that everything had been shaved off already by the rogue wave. The hard dodger, which had the backup EPIRB attached to it, had just been shaved right off and had sunk. The pedestal, the same. This was a center cockpit unit. That should have been fairly well protected, but gone. But what happened, I believe, is that the canister just slowly went down on its tether and held on its tether. Didn't go down hard enough to ignite the system. But the boat, when it came back so brutally. I think that is what jerked the tether and started the inflation process of the raft, which came up under the rig upside down. My first order of priority was to free it from the rig because it was being torn to pieces already. Already the canopy had been torn halfway off. The sea anchors underneath it, I had to cut away because they were entangled in. And so I managed to lift the rig enough to push it forward and then blow it over the stern with the wind and attach it to the starboard side, which was under the wind. From there, this was about 3 in the morning now, I knew there was no hull breach. We had the rig, which was bent very clean and almost two-thirds cut off at deck level. And I knew I could cut and jettison that very quickly because all the force stays were already torn off. My objective was to get rid of the rig, get rid of my 100 and some meters of chain and anchor in the bow. Plug the mass hole passage. So
at this point, you were really hoping to stay with the vessel.
Oh, absolutely. The plan was, I'd already been through very heavy weather. In 96, I went through the tail end of Bertha on a crossing. I had already rehearsed. I knew exactly what my game plan would be under these circumstances. When I went down below, they had already had the pumps going and everything. And Ben had had a great idea. He had used some of the 5-gallon jugs of water cut off the side, with the handles, and they were scooping water out that way. But to my shock, when I looked at the cradle where the deep herb was, it was no longer strobing. It was just inactive. I didn't have any more SSB because that was the antenna was in the backstay and the tuner anyway was drowned. The sat phone was soaked. It hadn't been secured. The DSCVHF. I had a spare antenna and a rigging point for it, but after the 360, trying to find it was just about impossible. For me, the last hope was that EPIRB, and my panic was it just wasn't working. I thought the other one had sunk with a hard dodger. Because it didn't have a hydrostatic release. It was a 406, but I had bought in 95. I thought it was still in its little holder attached to that hard dodger at the bottom of the sea. Luckily for us, somehow I guess it had been ejected from its holder when the waves hit and had somehow got itself working. So I suspect it fell immediately in the water.
Mm-hmm.
I lost about a half hour trying to reinitialize this GPIRB to no avail. It just would not. It was dead. It was dead. And I failed to understand why, because again, it had been serviced by River Services up in Georgia 2 weeks before we left, like the life raft.
All right, let's. I really want to concentrate on the GPIRB problem. Can you go over the rescue in brief, just to the point where we already heard the details. If you could just kind of fill in the blanks for us, for our listeners.
Yep. On the GPIRB itself.
On the rescue with the.
Okay. On the rescue.
Did you see the C-130 come overhead?
I did rather late. My two crew members did before. I had 10 broken ribs and two back problem compressions. And on top of that, I was in hypothermia. We abandoned ship at about 5:20. And from what I reconstituted, the first overflight was at about 6:30. They flew over us, I understand, 5 or 6 times before they found us. They were still getting a faint signal, homing signal, but they could not see us for two reasons. One, there was no fluorescent canopy on the life raft. Second, the life raft kept blowing over between the waves and the wind. We were crawling back on it all the time. We had a couple flares, but they didn't work very well. We had lost most of the flares in the near destruction of the life raft. From what I understand, because Rudy talked with the C-130 crew, it's on their 7th overflight that at the end of the passage, all of a sudden, they saw the last flare we had. And that's when they tried to launch another life raft, because they thought we weren't in a life raft, but something that had been assembled haphazardly. But the winds and the seas were just impossible. I mean, there was no way that they could get it anywhere close to us. Then they basically stayed on position until the helicopter arrived about an hour and a half later, I believe.
So your EPIRB, you watched it fail, and you thought the other one had been lost. An hour and a half before the C-130 came, that must have been a great feeling to see the Coast Guard above.
Oh, it was a miracle. It was a miracle. I knew my crew were just as worried as I was, but for me, there was no hope. There was no hope because I thought that GPIRB had failed let alone be registered to a different boat, which was absolutely crazy. That I didn't know it was registered to another boat. Then I would have really
been worried.
Excuse me?
You would have really been worried had you known that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But I didn't have much hope, honestly, because without that second EPIRB, I couldn't imagine how they would know we were out there.
So then the helicopter arrived. Can you run us through your side of the rescue there? It must have been difficult with the broken ribs and such problems.
Yeah, I was in and out of consciousness, basically, so I didn't really see much of it. I heard Rudy, basically, my Canadian crewmate, say that a helicopter was there, and I came out of my torpor a little bit, and then the next thing I remember is Drew Dezzo basically coming up to the raft and saying something in a rather cheerful mood, which I don't remember the words at all of. Then I think I lost consciousness again, I think, until I reached the helicopter, because the crew had me evacuated first. And they gave me oxygen, and I regained consciousness quite quickly. I know they were having a heck of a tough time getting down there and trying to get the other two crew members. Drew came up once. After he had, I think, sprained his back, and he was white as paper. And then they tried to do something without the basket. That basket with the 70 plus knots of wind and the wave structure was dangerous. He then went back down. And had the basket sent back down after him, and then they pulled Rudy out. After that, they pulled Ben out. It was a miracle, and the courage these guys had to do what they did was just as incredible, and it was a day that was just full of miracles. Full of miracles for that second EPIRB to have not sunk. Full of the miracles for that second EPIRB to have functioned. Full of miracles because if there had been a fourth person involved, someone would have stayed in the water. The cable of the helicopter unraveled when they pulled the Drew out for the last time. Not much more one can say.
It was an amazing rescue. Great job by them. And I encourage everyone to go back and listen to episode 12. We'll have links in our show notes. You can hear firsthand from the crew the tale of the harrowing rescue. I think we're all impressed. I want to get back to the EPIRB issue. Right before this podcast, we discussed last week's episode with Master Salver Rob Stormer. There were a couple inconsistencies you want to go over. Can you first tell us details about the two EPIRBs that you had?
Yes. The older EPIRB was registered to a boat, a couple boats removed. I had in 95 when I did my first solo crossing. That was one of the first 406s. As I sold the boat in Europe to a non-U.S. national, I kept that EPIRB used it as a backup. It self-tested every time, so I said to myself, it's a backup. And I'd like to recommend to anybody out there who might be in a similar situation with an old EPIRB saying it's a backup, change the battery. The battery of Lupontai's EPIRB lasted 11 hours, which was enough to save us. Had we had been much further out to sea, those 11 hours of battery would not have sufficed to enable help to reach us in time.
Yeah, absolutely. But the new eProbe, the gProbe, I understand it shuts off for 20 minutes and then sends a signal to last the battery longer. But you had problems with that one. That one died as well.
Yes, that is the one. That is the one I had bought 4.5 years prior. Actually, I had bought it for my 2002 crossing. And that one basically was sent to ACR's accredited service station up in Georgia just prior to our departure. And they came back saying it's in good shape, no problem. Your battery is good until at least November. And anyway, these batteries last an extra 5 years on average. So we put it back in its cradle where it was during the whole event. Which was basically right at the base of the gangway. When we pulled it, it started functioning fine. It started strobing. It went through the whole regular process. It took about between the moment I came back down after the life raft, I suspect it's about 30 minutes. And when I came down, it was dead. It was just not functioning at all. I can't say why. We still haven't done the post-mortem on that. We're hoping to do that fairly shortly, as soon as we find specialists who can look into it.
I do know a little bit about lithium-ion batteries, which is the type carried on most ePIRBs. One of the real advantages to a lithium-ion battery is they maintain the same voltage right up till the end. That is also a disadvantage because you can't use a regular battery tester on this type of battery to determine its age. The only real way to determine how far gone it is to do a battery count. And that's not a system built into ePIRB. That's actually like a timer that times how much, times when the electricity has gone through. And that's something maybe ePIRB manufacturers have to look into because technicians obviously are hopefully put this on, tested the voltage on it, and it tested okay, but the battery had not been fully charged. So it's an interesting point.
Yes, that is.
So replacing the battery is a good idea, you suggest?
Yes, I would at this point. They say it's good for 5 years. Now, why did it fail? I don't know. What I do know is that the service station didn't do its job because the service station is supposed to put it in a cage, read the hex code, make sure the hex code corresponds to the decal which NOAA supplies and is affixed to the side of it. And obviously they didn't check the hex code because if they had checked it, they would have realized there was something wrong. So here again, that's the next element, which is critical for people to go out and make sure that their system doesn't have a mess up there.
And we went over that in length in the interview with Rob Stormer, but I just want to reiterate the fact that you need to check this hex code yourself. It's supposed to be checked by the service stations, but it's your equipment. You can go on NOAA's website. beaconregistration.noaa.gov. And if you are the owner, you can check the hex code yourself, verify that your information is up to date. If you are not the owner, you need to say you're a vessel crew member or you're going on someone else's boat. You need to call NOAA directly, and the phone number there is U.S. code +1 301-817-4515. Call them up. Anyone can do it. Grab your EPIRB, read off the hex code, and they'll read back the information they have on file. Great. So do you have any other comments about the EPIRB themselves? Anything you'd like to see changed in the EPIRB system?
I would like there to be some form of a mandatory verification of the system, because reading off the hex code that's on the label and the hex code that is going to be emitted by the EPIRB in case it is needed are still two different things. And at this point, what we don't understand is why the hex code that the Coast Guard received corresponded to a boat called Cold Duck, and the hex code that's on the label of the EPIRB, just under the name of the boat Sean Seymour 2, is Sean Seymour 2's.
Interesting. So what happened that particular day? The information got confused, and they called the person who they pulled up in the computer. Is that correct?
Correct. They contacted the owner of Cold Duck. From what I understand, again, they asked him to go to his EPIRB to disconnect the battery, which I understand he did, and the signal ceased, but ceased, it seems, at the same time as my EPIRB died. So for the Coast Guard, they considered it was Cold Duck's EPIRB that was emitting erroneously, and they abandoned pursuit of that signal, rightly so.
But they didn't verify the locational information they received.
That I do not know. Okay. That I do not know. What I do know is that they also were receiving a signal from the old EPIRB, and that's what they went after.
Interesting.
Okay. I mean, had it not been for that backup EPIRB, I would just be with my crew part of the statistics lost at sea. Just like Flying Colors, who was 80 miles up to my starboard, off my starboard, and that disappeared completely with two professional skippers on board.
Yeah, it was a real tragedy of the day. So, what redundancy is really what seems to have saved you here, having a second system. You wrote a 10 lessons learned from the incident for G-Captain. We're going to post that article you wrote, which is an excellent guide of tips of what to do if you're sailing somewhere where you can encounter severe weather. Can you give us kind of a few lessons learned that are specific to the EPIRB? What you would do differently and what you're going to do different on your next vessel?
On my next vessel, I'm going to make sure that the signal that the EPIRB emits corresponds to the decal. And I'm going to make sure that hex code is registered with NOAA with the appropriate information. And by appropriate information, it's not only because there I made some mistakes also. I didn't update the vitals of the registration. In other words, I had moved in the interim. My telephone numbers had moved in the interim, and the points of contact were no longer valid, excepting my mother, thank God. They woke up at about 1 in the morning up on Cape Cod. That is also important, is to make sure that the Coast Guard knows who to contact if that comes about.
Check it at the beginning of every season and before any major trips. It's a really
exactly,
good idea.
Exactly. Updating your telephone numbers, the points of contact in case there's an emergency. I think that is very important. The second is I know it's expensive, but you can't let your life cling on a battery. Don't wait till the 5 years is up. Maybe it's 3 years. Maybe there's some better means of testing it. I don't know. But there again, it's a basic precaution that has to be taken. The third is redundancy. I've always been a bit of a redundancy freak. I try to have at least two of everything, but redundancy is fine, and that's what I say also in one of my lessons learned. Oh, it's great to feel comfortable having a backup beeper, just make sure you have a new battery in it. Again, because if we had been 1,500 miles out on our way to the Azores and run into a similar circumstance, there's very little chance in the 11 hours of battery that was left in that EPIRB that help would have reached us in time.
Real interesting. There are a few other options available. One is you can rent an EPIRB. There are a number of places, especially it's a lot cheaper. And again, you can check the hex code of the rental place by calling NOAA itself. There are personal locator beacons, which are small EPIRBs that can be clipped to the life jacket. Or you can have the service station of your life raft put one of these PLBs inside the life raft. Obviously, there are GPIRBs, hydrostatic released, the best option. And some new systems like the Spot Personal Messenger, which is not a replacement for an EPIRB, but does give you maybe a third level of redundancy. Are you looking at any of these technologies for future voyages, or what are your plans?
My plan is to stay with the EPIRB at this point. I still think it's for me, with my knowledge, it's the best system out there. As long as you have a few precautions, it's a proven technology. I'm sure that there are other systems out there, but I don't know enough about
this worked for you. It got you rescued, and that's the real message of the day. This really saved your life. This combined with the Coast Guard's heroism and willingness to go out were the real two factors that got you back. Being prepared, probably the third, huh?
Yes, indeed.
Right. Any final notes? I would love to bring you back on and discuss your third boat. Any final notes? I also want to, we're going to have in the show notes a link to your final log entry, which is a written account of what happened that day, and your new blog, which talks about your upcoming the show on Seymour 3. But any final notes on this incident? And
yes, I published the 11th lesson learned, and I suspect you'll want to talk with the C-130 crew about that. I wasn't there. Rudy again was there. It appears that it took them six overflights. Well, okay, when they finally found us, They immediately reported back that they had found a life raft with two survivors. The Coast Guard immediately called my mother, saying they found the life raft there with two survivors, and she, of course, said, no, no, there are three. And so they continued overflying, and I understand it's only at the sixth overflight that they saw that there were effectively three survivors in the life raft. Now, why? It appears that under those conditions, and the life raft had no cover, so they could see what was in the life raft. Two of us had yellow heavy weather gear on. The third had red. And it took about an hour for them to report that, yes, there was a third. And that third was the one in red.
Yeah, we discussed during the podcast with the rescue helicopter team and with the C-130, I wrapped up each podcast. We haven't had the opportunity to let Jean-Pierre listen to the C-130 yet, but we asked them for their lessons learned, and each crew member of the helicopter and the C-130 pilot, their chief lesson learned was be visible. Make sure they can see you, do everything you can, and that's something, a lesson we really need to bring away from here.
Yes, I think it's very important. Whether it's a man overboard or an extreme circumstance like this, I don't know how many out there have had to bring a man overboard back under difficult weather conditions, difficult visibility. I know by experience that yellow is the most visible color on the water. So for all of the design and aesthetics and all of that, visibility is critical.
And make sure it has the reflective tape for night as well. It's very difficult to see any color. So yellow and reflective tape. Those are really good tips. And I want to thank you for your time today, Jean-Pierre, and encourage, we're going to have links to his blog on the show notes and include some of the background information. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks. Thank you for having me, John.
All right. We want to thank everyone who participated in this interview series. I've really enjoyed it, and we want to thank them. A few things came up since we recorded this last interview. That Rob Stormer's been doing an extensive investigation into this topic, and he wanted me to bring up a few points. One, the commenter earlier alluded to, there is no central database. Each country has its own database. And on top of that, when an EPIRB is thrown away or expires, it's not like a car where you turn in your license plate and they delete you off the computer. The database is growing and not being cut down. Rob Stormer thinks that's something that needs to be changed. Second is no autopsies are being performed on these failed EPIRBs. You have the option of sending it into the manufacturer, but Rob really questions, not that they can't be trusted, but a third party really needs to be performing these autopsies, possibly the Coast Guard. But we're really looking for a laboratory or some experts to really set up something where a failed EPIRB can be brought in and found out exactly why it failed. Currently, we do not have that, and that really troubles both me and Rob. A last point is something that really surprised me. There's no quality testing, no random testing. As we all know, we have in the Merchant Marine, we are all subject to random drug testing. It's a good way to kind of get statistics on the drug use in the Merchant Marine and to weed out the worst offenders. There's nothing similar for EPIRBs. We're really calling for the Coast Guard to start performing some random testing, going down to docks and vessels, and pulling the EPIRBs, lighting them off, and seeing if they work or not, so we can get some statistics into this prom. Either that or a real full-scale investigation, but something needs to change, Peter.
Well, John, you're absolutely right. I've really enjoyed this whole series, and I've learned a lot about EPIRBs and GPIRBs and the exposures. I mean, I think we think a lot of times about the safety equipment is fail-safe, and it in fact is not. And there is definitely opportunity for improving the system. So, if we can make a little contribution to this through the podcast, I think that would be a good thing. And I think your interviews and analysis of what transpired here is pretty unique, that we are able to look at it from so many different perspectives. I think you did a fantastic job. And although I'm your partner here in the podcast, I've been a big fan of this series. So I commend you and Rob and all the other interviewees. I think it's been quite educational.
It's something amazing. These guys go out and they do this on a daily basis. Obviously, this was an extreme case, but those Coast Guardmen really should be commended. And I think highlighting some of these EPIRB have the potential to save lives. This is literally the one piece of equipment that's going to send the Coast Guard knocking on your door, your cabin, in an emergency. So it's important, and I've enjoyed doing the interview.
Yeah, well, we've devoted a lot of time to this, and that's only because it's important, it's necessary, and hopefully we'll shine a little bit of a light on some of the issues, and hopefully we can make some progress in these areas. So,
I hope so too. And if you have any comments about this episode, future episodes, or if you would like to be interviewed on Messing About in Ships, please contact us. You can leave a comment on our blog, messingaboutinships.com. You can send an email to podcast@messingaboutinships.com. You can visit gcaptain.com, leave a comment on the forum or blog, or seafever.org, that's seafever.org. Skype, we're MIS Podcast, and the easiest way to contact us is by phone 206-973-7000. Leave a message, we'll play it on the air.
Well, great, great. That's no excuse. Get a hold of us. Participate. Social media. Get involved. John, another great week. I really enjoyed it, as usual, and I'm looking forward already to next week.
Me too, Peter. Can't wait.
As usual, this week's music comes to us from the PodSafe Music Network. The band is The Great Big Sea. It's a Canadian folk rock band from Newfoundland and Labrador, and they're best known for their energetic rock interpretations of traditional Newfoundland folk songs, including sea shanties. This week, they do a cover of a song made famous by the band R.E.M., and it's called The End of the World.
It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. That's great, it starts with an earthquake, birds, snakes, and aeroplanes. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane, listen to yourself, turn world with its own needs. Dummy, save your own needs, speed it up, and our speed got no speed. The ladder starts to clatter with the fear, fight down, fight. Firing a fire, represent the seven gangs, the government for hiring a combat site. Pressure wasn't coming in a hurry, with the fury beating down your neck. Two veteran reporters, grapple, jump, hit the ground, look at that low plane, fine then. Upflow, overflow, population corner, good, but it'll lose. Save yourself, a world, save your own needs, listen to your heart. Tell me that the rich are in the red room at the right. You patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, right, my feeling, criticize. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine. Oh, 6 o'clock, TV hour, don't get gotten boring. Now, session, Murray, turn, listen to yourself. Journal, like a mini uniform, a book of burning, but a Latin, every motive estimated. Not a motive, incinerate, not a motive, right? Crush up all these speeds, no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear, turn them in a five. You want the solution, the novel, the alternative, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
know it, and I feel fine. Time's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.